Today is Tuesday, June 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a historic summit as President Trump and North Korea's leader come face to face. President Trump continues to tweet his displeasure with allies over trade.
We've had these ups and downs in the relationship before, not as countries per se, but between presidents and prime ministers.
U.S. Attorney General moves to limit eligibility for asylum. Also ahead, the Impossible Burger, making the most meat-like plant-based burger. It's all on today's International Edition. U.S. President Donald Trump said a one-on-one meeting with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un was very, very good, and he spoke of having an excellent relationship as they held talks Tuesday in Singapore about the possible denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Tuesday's unprecedented events with the first meeting of a sitting U.S. president in North Korea began with Trump and Kim coming together in front of a background of U.S. and North Korean flags as dozens of cameras snapped photos. And joining us now live from Singapore is VOA's Nike Ching. Nike, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
Tell us what you know so far about the meetings. Apparently, they had a one-on-one, and now they've been meeting with their advisors, and that's been going on for how long?
For quite about 1 hour, 1.5 hours, and after that would be a working lunch. So we shall see very soon what comes out of the meeting. And later, 4 p.m., President Trump will have a press conference, and we expect we will know more about the substance being discussed. So after the handshake is 9 o'clock, the history starts. The meeting starts at Tuesday morning, Singapore time, 9 a.m. Both leaders walk in the meeting with no smile, businesslike. But later, after they sit down, we can see brief smiles in their face. Following the initial greeting, President Trump and Kim Jong-un participated in a one-on-one meeting with the translators only. This is the opportunity for them to know each other, see how chemistry works, because it's very important. The leaders' chemistry will affect the bilateral relations between two countries. And later is an expanded bilateral meeting and a working lunch. President Trump said at the beginning, the United States and North Korea will have a terrific relationship, no doubt. When he sat down for the first time with North Korea leader Kim Jong-un, he also said that he is looking forward to having a new relationship with the country. North Korea leader Kim Jong-un told President Trump that we came here after overcoming all the obstacles. So on the spot at the Capella Hotel, reporters said they cannot recall ever seeing arrangement of the United States and North Korea's flags side by side like this. Back to Lori.
Yeah, Nike, did you hear any mention of plans to talk in the near future, or is it too soon to know what anything of substance came of it?
President Trump has been saying that this is a process. The meeting on Tuesday just opened up a series of meetings, more talks. So earlier, some experts is saying that something to look for is to see if there will be a peace agreement to officially ending the war situation that lasted for 7 decades. We understand earlier President Trump tweeted meetings between staff and representatives between U.S. and North Korea are going well and quickly than anticipated. But in the end, it doesn't matter because this is the start of a real deal, a real process. I heard some observers are voicing different tone. Some said that the United States is giving North Korea Kim Jong-un just what he wanted, which is a global stage for his live international debut, which put him on the same footing as the president of the United States. Even before we heard North Korea is committed to CVID, which stands for complete, irreversible, verifiable denuclearization. Back to Lurie.
All right. Well, it'll certainly be interesting to see what comes out of this historic meeting, and we know you'll be right there covering it, and we thank you so much. That's VOA's Nike Ching coming to us live from Singapore. Thank you, Nike.
You're welcome.
Well, while in Singapore, President Donald Trump also tweeted out more criticism of U.S. trade partners Monday, including allies in Europe and Canada. And after attending a meeting of G7 leaders, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau called Trump's decision to invoke national security grounds to impose new tariffs on aluminum and steel insulting. Trudeau pledged to respond with equivalent tariffs on U.S. goods beginning July 1st. Joining us now to discuss is Peter MacKay, former member in Parliament of Canada, and he also served as Canada's Attorney General and Minister of Justice and Minister of National Defense. He's currently a partner at Baker McKenzie in Toronto. Thanks for being with us. What do you make of all of this?
Well, I think it's fair to say it's been strained and stressed, but not beyond repair. And we've had these ups and downs in the relationship before, not as countries per se, but between presidents and prime ministers. Nixon and the current prime minister, Justin Trudeau's father, had a notoriously bad relationship. President Kennedy and John Diefenbaker at the time. And we even had a well-documented incident where your President Johnson grabbed our Prime Minister Pearson by the lapels over differences on Vietnam. We have to get beyond the personal and get back to, more importantly, what binds us together, and that is such an abiding historic relationship, whether it's military to military, whether it's our cooperation around the defense and promotion of North America, and our relationship through a number of important international bodies. And people to people, we really are members of the same family.
How do we do that when we have a situation like we're in right now, when there's a huge clash and difference of opinion and even sort of a difference in fact almost?
Well, I think we get back to the facts and get back to the importance of seeing the mutual benefit in working together, whether it's on trade, as I mentioned, or certainly for security, and move away from the personal and invective. And I think one of the facts that has to be revisited is the overwhelming success of free trade between our countries, which has exceeded all expectations. You know, $1 billion a day across so many different sectors. And while the economies of both countries are different in size and dependence in some ways, I can't help but think that some of the changes that are being contemplated, or, you know, goodness forgive if we break up this free trade agreement, it's the consumers who will suffer. And we're seeing that already in the steel and aluminum tariffs, auto sector threats around our ag sector. We are the United States. Canada is the United States' biggest customer. And there isn't a deficit, in fact. There is a surplus in favor of the United States when it comes to the amount of product and trade that we buy from the United States. And so we really have to be firm in the assertion that while there may be deficits, there's huge deficits with China, with Mexico, with the European Union, that is simply not the fact and not the case with Canada. We're your best customer and we're your best friend.
Those are the facts according to everything that we have seen, but President Trump doesn't seem to hear that. How do you convince him of that? And how are Canadians feeling about all of this?
Well, as I said, there's frustration, but those are the facts from, you know, the United States Commerce Secretary. These are the facts when you talk to chambers of commerce and industry leaders and sector leaders and senators and House of Representatives, people who are in the know. You have to be persistent, I guess, and consistent in stating that truth. And this isn't to suggest you can go around a United States president, but there is a Congress. There are other important voices, too. We don't want to have to continually go through challenges, either through the NAFTA dispute resolution mechanism or WTO, but those options exist. It's certainly not the preferred option. And, you know, in spite of all the white noise and some of the acrimony, I still, for one, believe that we'll get past this because there is a common value and a common respect that we have shared as nations, as neighbors. I certainly believe very much in the power of this relationship. And I do shudder when I hear the leaders of Russia and the leadership of Iran and others taking glee in the divisions and the derision that has occurred at the G7. This is again, not at all to diminish the importance of what President Trump is trying to do in North Korea. But I come back to, we are allies. We are in common cause, and we support the efforts that the president is making in Korea, but we also expect, and I think rightly so, that we will be able to count on one another in many ways, and that relationship is not there in some of the other ventures that the president has been on.
Why do you think that the president seems to be so hard on allies and generous in many ways with adversaries?
Well, that is the quintessential question, I suppose, and it has left many scratching their heads. To some degree, you can be, on occasion, hardest on those you're closest to, and that happens in families, it happens in all sorts of close relationships. But there's always a reconciling, and there's always an ability, even in moments of tension and hard times, to come back to what binds us together, the humanity of what is important in the relationship. And I have to be hopeful, and all Canadians, I think, want to believe that we will not escalate, but de-escalate and get back to the very essence of this shared responsibility that we have in North America. I think a lot of Canadians find a great deal of solace in the voice of John McCain and other senior members of Congress who have spoken out and sent very encouraging words. And, you know, going back even to 9/11 and the thousands of Americans who were stranded and given sanctuary in Canadians' homes, those are the really important person-to-person human relations that will get us through times like this.
All right, that's Peter MacKay. He is the former member of Parliament of Canada, also serving as Canada's Attorney General, Minister of Justice, and Minister of National Defense, currently a partner with Baker McKenzie in Toronto. We thank you. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The Afghan suicide bomber kills at least 12 in Kabul. Facebook says it needs to do more to tackle hate speech in Myanmar. Attacks in the Central African Republic kill one peacekeeper. And Leo Sarkisian, founder of VOA's Music Time in Africa program, has died. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. After years of research and $400 million from investors, Impossible Foods has produced the hottest new... I'm sorry, I believe that might have been... We were jumping a little bit ahead there for you. We are talking about a new policy just enacted by the Trump administration. And that would be Attorney General Jeff Sessions moving to deny asylum to victims of domestic abuse and gang violence, narrowing the definition of asylum and potentially barring tens of thousands of people from getting it. Sessions Monday ruled in the case of one Salvadorian woman known only by the initials on her immigration papers as AB, who requested asylum 4 years ago after being raped and beaten by her ex-husband over more than a decade. Joining us now to talk about it is Florida-based immigration attorney Angelina Castro. What is your reaction to this latest decision?
This decision affects 80% of my asylum cases, which is devastating to me and to all the asylum attorneys I know out there, and to tens of thousands of women, children, and men who are fleeing violence from gangs and violence from domestic partners and family members. There's this grave lack of protection for so many of these groups in Central America. And I think that this decision that Sessions made is not only unprecedented, but flies in the face of well-developed precedent.
This case and this decision was based on a Salvadorian woman who requested asylum 4 years ago after being raped and beaten by her ex-husband over more than a decade?
That's right. This is not unlike many of the cases that we have and many of the cases that we see. There simply isn't protection for these women, and a lot of these men who are abusing women are either political leaders or able to pay off the local law enforcement and judiciary so that nothing is done against them.
Isn't the whole point of asylum, though, people that are escaping violence, or does it go more specifically to sort of a wartime situation?
Oh, no, not at all. An individual applying for asylum has to show persecution on account of one of five grounds: nationality, race, political opinion, membership in a particular social group, or a religious persecution. So if they fit into any one of those, then they would have a cognizable claim for asylum. In a situation where they're pleading asylum based on domestic violence, it's because they are a member of a particular social group, the social group being women, or family members who are unable to flee violence in the home because the laws and the authorities are unable to or unwilling to protect them. There's nothing they can do to change their situation. They can't change who they are. They can't change their gender. They can't change their membership in that family that participates in this kind of violence. So that has historically been a protected ground.
It certainly seems like we are allowing less and less people to enter this country, whether it be through asylum, through immigration, refugees. Is that an accurate statement, or were we just having an influx that needed to be dealt with?
No, I think it's extremely accurate. Being someone who's been in the refugee business for 31 years, I worked overseas in the refugee processing centers with the U.S. government, the Department of State. And I saw what it took to be a refugee back then. And I worked with asylum seekers, screening them at refugee processing sites. Jeff Sessions gave a speech to the immigration judges, and he said, we've got to stop this lawlessness. He cited some statistics of how only 20% of the asylum cases were granted by the immigration judges in 2016. And the reason why that number is so low is because they've just made it so much more difficult. And in the first domestic violence case, I believe it was Matter of RA, the Department of Justice and Department of Homeland Security attorneys even conceded that they recognized domestic violence as a viable ground of protection under the particular social group classification. Sessions' decision is an about-face of all of the things that have been decided by previous courts, by the Board of Immigration Appeal, by federal courts, and even by the Department of Homeland Security.
Something else that is also being done that's never been done before in the United States is the separation of families, children from their parents at the border. My understanding is that not all of these people are crossing over illegally. Some of them are requesting asylum and they're still being separated from their children. Is some of them, we've heard, children in cages? Is that legal in the United States?
Well, if you look at our state laws and even most international laws, when we're talking about the rights of children, guiding light has always been to protect children to the greatest extent possible and to do whatever is in the best interest of the child. That's an international standard. That's certainly a first world standard. That's the standard of historically of our democracy, and that's not happening. And even in the Flores Agreement of 2009, where the government said we've got to minimize the time these kids spend in detention centers, even with their parents, because it's not good for them. It's not in their best interest, and we need to do no harm. We need to do the least harm possible to these children because it has a permanent and lasting effect on them, and it's a traumatizing experience, especially in cases where they're leaving situations of trauma. So this is a real stain on our history in America, and it's happening right before our eyes.
That's Florida-based immigration attorney Angelina Castro. We appreciate your time. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
This is Russ Davis. Join me as I take you to the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C. for the induction of Joanne Brackeen, Diane Reeves, and Pat Metheny into the hallowed hall of NEA Jazz Masters. The 2018 NEA Jazz Masters on the next Jazz America.
Hey, Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, after years of research and $400 million from investors, Impossible Foods has produced the hottest new item on the vegan market, meat-free burgers. The goal of the California-based startup is to make an all-natural organic product that can deliver the pleasure people get from eating meat, but with no cholesterol, antibiotics, hormones, harmful bacteria, or meat. Faiza El-Masri prepared the story with Faith Lapidus narrating.
It looks like meat. It sizzles on the grill like meat. It tastes like meat. But it's not meat. It's the Impossible Burger, and it's entirely plant-based. It uses a fraction of the resources needed to get a burger from a cow, and many meat eaters admit they actually prefer it. The vegan burger has four major natural ingredients. Wheat, which provides protein, potato protein, which binds it together, an essence of coconut that gives it its juiciness, and a special ingredient.
We're the only one who has this. It has something called heme, H-E-M-E. Turns out heme, which is in the blood of an animal, is also in everything. It's in plants as well. We figured out a way to make it from a naturally occurring source in a plant. And as a result, only the Impossible Burger can have the unique meatiness that you get from a burger from a cow.
Tal Ronan, chef and owner of Crossroads Kitchen, a high-end vegan restaurant in Los Angeles, calls it a game changer.
It's, you know, changed the way people perceive of what a plant-based burger can be. Even though we're a plant-based restaurant, we really do serve mostly non-vegetarians. So it's been very popular for our non-vegetarian customers.
Umami Burger, which specializes in gourmet burgers, is one of the thousands of restaurants now selling the Impossible Burger and says demand for it is increasing. That's good news for Impossible Foods executive David Lee.
We founded the company and we're running the company so that we can have an impact that can be seen from outer space. So in addition to the United States, we recently launched in Hong Kong, not just because it's a wonderful place that great foodies love, it's also a place that sets food trends across Asia.
The company's new factory in Oklahoma has the capacity to create more than 5.5 million Impossible Burgers a month, which means it's not impossible to imagine them appearing on more and more restaurant menus across the United States and around the world. For writer Faiza El-Masri, I'm Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
And turning now to the latest movies to hit U.S. theaters, we are joined by Vegas film critic Jeffrey K. Howard. Jeff, let's start with Adrift. This is based on a true story, which I think can really add to the emotion of a movie.
We've seen movies where they're lost at sea before, you know. It's not like it's a new phenomenon, but it's about this woman's ordeal delivering a sailing boat from Tahiti to San Diego. And she's in Tahiti. She meets the love of her life. She has this whirlwind romance. They're delivering this yacht kind of sailboat when the worst Category 5 storm in the Pacific in recorded history hit their boat. And it was so damaged that they were adrift for 41 days. And her fiancé was badly hurt. So she was essentially alone the entire time on this boat. She's not a sailor. The radio's not working. Supplies are limited. And so it's about her survival. And what's really unique about the movie, how it plays it out, it doesn't do it in a linear fashion. It's not one event after another. So it goes to flashback how she met her fiancé, about their romance, about her attitude, about her life, you know, being traveling and doing all these things. And it just intercuts it back and forth with after the hurricane hit. So I love how they pace the movie like that. And it's funny, one of the things she ate on the boat that helped her survive was peanut butter. That she said peanut butter saved her life.
Wow.
You know, and that's what's also really cool about Shailene Woodley. She has this emotional range in the movie because mm-hmm. she's essentially acting to nothing being there, you know, like being mm-hmm. lost at sea, you know.
Right.
So she really, really delivers a great performance. And they had a boat that took them out for 3 hours in the middle of nowhere. They're shooting this movie on the water. So there's a realism to it. Mm-hmm. There's a desperation. There's adventure. There's courage. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was really, really an exciting story. And I had the honor of interviewing the actual woman who wrote the book and the movie is based on, Tammy Oldham Ashcraft. And she gives some great stories about how Hollywood took her book, about how she was involved with the production, how she survived. And it's available on my YouTube channel. It's a great interview.
That's very cool. And I'm sure it was really, really neat seeing the movie and being able to talk to the actual person that went through that.
I loved it. Yeah, that's what I love about my job is you get to talk to the actual person.
That's very cool. Well, speaking of the high seas, we've got Ocean's 8.
Talking about high seas and high stakes, we have, back Danny Ocean. George Clooney made the famous the original Ocean's 11. This time, it's Danny Ocean's sister, played by Sandra Bullock. She was betrayed by a lover who was in the art world, so she got arrested for fraud, and she spent 5 years in jail, but she was plotting the ultimate heist. And they were going to the Met Gala, where they were going to steal a necklace from Cartier, worn by Anne Hathaway's character, that's worth $150 million. So I saw the trailer for this, Laurie, and I'm like, oh, really? It just looked corny. It looked sappy. But you know what? I couldn't believe how much fun I had. It's hip. It's realistic, meaning that if you're going to do a heist movie, audiences are sophisticated. So when they're planning their heist and they're executing all the moves and the cool jazz music going with it, you really believe they're pulling this off. And of course, there's twists and turns, not only problems that happen during the heist, but also after, towards the end of the movie, there's some great twists in it. And she assembled the best cast, Helena Bonham Carter, Cate Blanchett, you know, Rihanna. Everybody's got their job to do on the team. It's a lot of fun. I mean, I think this is a great date movie.
Oh, wow. So you actually are two for two this week. You liked both of them.
Yeah, believe it or not. Yeah. So I was really surprised because I was going into Ocean's 8 going, really, you know, we've seen this all before.
Right.
But the characters really sell it, and having this all-female star team, they really pull it off. It's a lot of fun.
Jeffrey K. Howard, you can find his full video reviews at VegasFilmCritic.com. Thank you so much for joining us here on International Edition. Find us anytime at VOAnews.com. And thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Dave Magnus. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In the wake of the United States' withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal and the renewed imposition by the U.S. of nuclear-related sanctions on Iran, many companies are ending their business involvement with Iran because they do not want to run afoul of U.S. sanctions. In an address in Washington, U.S. Treasury Undersecretary for Terrorism and Financial Intelligence, Sigal Mandelker, warned, however, that it is often difficult for businesses and governments to even know they are dealing with Iran because of the regime's employment of subterfuge to finance itself and its long list of malign activities.
It uses forged documents to hide its participants and deceive legitimate private and public actors. It finds what it perceives to be weak links and exploits those links in the hopes that its activities will go undetected. It uses officials with influence and credentials to facilitate its illicit transactions. And all of this in support of nefarious activity, whether it's funding terrorists, supporting WMD proliferation, or exploiting its own people through corruption and human rights abuses.
Everyone must open their eyes to the true nature of the Iranian regime, Undersecretary Mandelker said. The reason why the U.S. has imposed sanctions on Iran is to thwart the regime's terrorist activity in the Middle East, its support for the murderous Assad regime in Syria, its development of ballistic missiles, and its rampant abuse of the Iranian people. Undersecretary Mandelker urged governments and banks around the world to be alert to Iran's deceptive practices. You must harden your financial networks, require your companies to do extra due diligence to keep them from being caught in Iran's deceptive web, and make clear the very significant risks of doing business with companies and persons in Iran. She declared, "We will hold those doing prohibited business in Iran to account." Addressing U.S. allies, Undersecretary Mandelker said, "We must work together to pressure Iran to make tangible, demonstrated, and sustained shifts in its policies." In the meantime, she added, "the United States will continue to shine a light on Iran's destructive activities and target Iran's efforts to deceive the international community, undermine the international financial system, and violate the laws of our allies and partners."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.